Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening to the start of a very interesting series here on U.S. foreign policy, namely the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Tonight being part one in this series, and as well, tonight is Wednesday the 10th. Of February 2010, Wednesday the 10th, 2010, February. The Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. I think we're going to open up some eyes, ladies and gentlemen, to just how much influence several of the lobbyist groups and private interest groups and NGOs, that's non-government organizations, have in that field. And many of you on the free Hour of the Time news list, subscribers that I personally am the one who sends it out, will have seen this track record for the last few years even. But first, the cursory information. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Eager, 928-333-2942, and the studio in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to comment, make suggestions, hate mail, share research, whatever, my personal email address is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, do not forget that the Hour of the Time is listener-supported, and through your support, we're able to expand our operation. Now, of course, you can go to the website, hourofthetime.com, and hit the donate button on the front page in the left column, and that's, of course, appreciated. But better yet even, why not go to the Hot Shop and donate for research materials? That way, it's beneficial for both parties. You can donate for DVDs or DVD packages even, printed materials, MP3, individual broadcast, survival goods, topical series. And in fact, there's many new postings there, even just today. We just wrapped up the series on Zionist violations, and we have a package deal there. All the broadcasts in that series in MP3 format, along with 80 UN PDF documents, resolutions, etc., to support everything that was said in that series. Because Hour of the Time is solution-oriented, and part of that solution is you, ladies and gentlemen, waking up. It doesn't mean Hour of the Time doing like most of the hosts out there in networks, just take every email and fax just in and read it on the air. It means verifying, solidifying, doing the research, and showing that research. I want you to take that, for instance, that package. A lot of hours went into getting all of those PDF documents. There's over 80 of them. All of those from the United Nations entity, gathering them all up, reading them, then doing the broadcast. You get the whole bundle very inexpensively. Go to the website, hourofthetime.com. Go to the Hot Shop. Now, I want you, and we do things like that, because I want you to go in and read them. Go ahead and prove me wrong. Tell me I misquoted something. It's all right there, ladies and gentlemen, as well as this new series out of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. The John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. And we will have some learning incentives for you besides your notes. Now, we will take the normal musical break at the beginning here for you to get settled in and ready for the rest of the broadcast and hour. And I would suggest, as always, have something to write with. Or, of course, you can wait till the series is done or each evening and get the individual MP3s if you want. Or donate for a whole month's worth at the end of each month if you like. That's another thing people do. Those are all ways to support our efforts here and let us expand even more because we need to. So again, right after this musical break, part one in our new broadcast series, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. The website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The mailing address, Hot, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. And the studio in Arizona phone is 928-333-2942. And the studio in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think you're going to be quite intrigued, and I suggest you take notes because you will have the opportunity to write down dates, policy names, group identifiers, key personnel, etc. in this long, twisty mess of the Israel lobby and its undue influence upon U.S. foreign policy, although quite well contrived and planned. Now, ironically, one of the professors that worked on this, Mearsheimer, out of the University of Chicago, I think Bam Bam, that's the guy that's in the White House right now, should have read this paper prior to him running for office. Of course, he didn't need to because he knew how he was going to behave already. But Mr. Mearsheimer and Mr. Walt, University of Chicago, Mr. Mearsheimer, and Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. Thank you very much for this excellent piece. U.S. foreign policy, ladies and gentlemen, shapes events in every corner of the globe. Nowhere is this truer than in the Middle East, a region of recurring instability and enormous strategic importance. Recently, the Bush administration's attempt to transform the region into a community of democracies has helped produce a resilient insurgency in Iraq, a sharp rise in world oil prices, terrorist bombings in Madrid, London, and Amman. With so much at stake for so many, all countries need to understand the forces that drive U.S. Middle East policy. The U.S. national interest should be the primary object of American foreign policy. For the past several decades, however, and especially since the Six-Day War in 1967, the centerpiece of U.S. Middle East policy has been its relationship with Israel. The combination of unwavering U.S. support for Israel and the related effort to spread democracy throughout the region has inflamed Arab and Islamic opinion and jeopardized U.S. security. The situation has no equal in American political history. Why the United States has been willing to set aside its own security in order to advance the interest of another state? One might assume that the bond between the two countries is based on shared strategic interest or compelling moral imperatives. As we shall show below, however, neither of those explanations can account for the remarkable level of material and diplomatic support that the United States provides to Israel. Instead, the overall thrust of U.S. policy in the region is due almost entirely to U.S. domestic politics, and especially to the activities of the Israel lobby. Certainly, other special interest groups have managed to skew U.S. foreign policy in directions they favored, but no lobby has managed to divert U.S. foreign policy as far from what the American national interest would otherwise suggest, while simultaneously convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical. In the broadcasts that follow, ladies and gentlemen, we will describe how the lobby has accomplished this feat and how its activities have shaped America's actions in this critical region. Given the strategic importance of the Middle East and its potential impact on others, both Americans and non-Americans need to understand and address the lobby's influence on U.S. policy. Some listeners will find this analysis disturbing, but the facts recounted here are not in serious dispute among scholars. Indeed, this account relies heavily on the work of Israeli scholars and journalists who deserve great credit for shedding light on these issues. We will also rely, ladies and gentlemen, on evidence provided by respected Israeli and international human rights organizations. And similarly, our claims about the lobby's impact rely on testimony from the lobby's own members, as well as testimony from politicians who have worked with them. Listeners, you have the right to ignore our conclusions, of course. But the evidence which we will lay out and which it rests upon is not controversial. Section 1, the Great Benefactor. And that's a hint for your notes, ladies and gentlemen. Since the October War in 1973, Washington has provided Israel with a level of support dwarfing the amounts provided to any other state. It has been the largest annual recipient of direct U.S. economic and military assistance since 1976, and the largest total recipient since World War II. Total direct U.S. aid to Israel amounts to well over $140 billion in 2003 dollars. Israel receives about $3 billion in direct foreign assistance each year, which is roughly one-fifth of America's total foreign aid budget. In per capita terms, the United States gives each Israeli a direct subsidy worth about $500 a year. This largesse is especially striking when one realizes that Israel is now a wealthy industrial state with a per capita income roughly equal to South Korea or Spain, and progressing right on our heels of the United States. Israel also gets other special deals from Washington. Other aid recipients get their money in quarterly installments, but Israel receives its entire appropriation at the beginning of each fiscal year and thus earns extra interest. Most recipients of American military assistance are required to spend all of it in the United States. But Israel can use roughly 25% of its aid allotment to subsidize its own defense industry. Israel is the only recipient that does not have to account for how the aid is spent, an exemption that makes it virtually impossible to prevent the money from being used for purposes the United States opposes, like building settlements in the West Bank. Moreover, the United States has provided Israel with nearly $3 billion to develop weapons systems, like the Lavi aircraft, that the Pentagon did not want or need, while giving Israel access to top-drawer U.S. weaponry, like Black Hawk helicopters and F-16 jets. Finally, the United States gives Israel access to its intelligence that it denies its NATO allies and has turned a blind eye towards Israel's acquisition of nuclear weapons. In addition, Washington provides Israel with consistent diplomatic support. Since 1982, the United States has vetoed 32 United Nations Security Council resolutions that were critical of Israel, a number greater than the combined total of vetoes cast by all the other Security Council members. It also blocks Arab states' efforts to put Israel's nuclear arsenal on the International Atomic Energy Agency's agenda. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget the series we just finished up on Zionist violations, the old package deal of MP3 broadcast, and over 80 PDF documents all in one bundled package for you, a way to support the Hour of the Time. We are listener-supported. And already, only 10 minutes into this series, you can see where the other broadcast series and documents would heavily substantiate what I've said in just 10 minutes, let alone all the sites you're going to get if you listen carefully tonight to a special offer we have on gratis for you observant and careful listeners. The United States, ladies and gentlemen, also comes to Israel's rescue in wartime and takes its side when negotiating peace. The Nixon administration, for instance, resupplied Israel during the October War and protected Israel from the threat of Soviet intervention. Washington was deeply involved in the negotiations that ended that war, as well as the lengthy step-by-step process that followed, just as it played a key role in the negotiations that preceded and followed the 1993 Oslo Accords. There were occasional frictions between U.S. and Israeli officials in both cases, but the United States coordinated its positions closely with Israel and consistently backed, the Israeli approach to the negotiations. Indeed, one American participant at Camp David in 2000 later said, quote, "Far too often we functioned as Israel's lawyer," end quote. And as we will discuss later, ladies and gentlemen, Washington has given Israel wide latitude in dealing with the occupied territories, namely the West Bank and Gaza Strip, even when its actions were at odds with stated U.S. policies. Moreover, the Bush administration's ambitious strategy to transform the Middle East, beginning with the invasion of Iraq, is at least partly intended to improve Israel's strategic situation. Apart from wartime alliances, it's hard to think of another instance where one country has provided another with a similar level of material and diplomatic support for such an extended period. America's support for Israel is, in short, unique. This extraordinary generosity might be understandable if Israel were a vital strategic asset, or if there were a compelling moral case for sustained U.S. backing. But neither rationale is convincing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the hour of the time. The only broadcast where you'll get this kind of information, this supported, this cited, this documented, that isn't afraid to say it either. Take a look around, ladies and gentlemen. Watch how many networks cower from this very topic, or like our last topic, Zionist violations. Look at our ADL series as well. Now, your next section for your notes, you might give a subheading as a strategic liability, ladies and gentlemen. Now, according to APAC, which is Alpha, India, Papa, Alpha, Charlie, APAC, AIPAC, that is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And you've heard lots about them if you're one of the free subscribers on our news list. According to their website, quote, the United States and Israel have formed a unique partnership to meet the growing strategic threats in the Middle East. This cooperative effort provides significant benefits for both the United States and Israel, end quote. This claim is an article of faith among Israel's supporters and is routinely invoked by Israeli politicians and pro-Israel Americans. Israel may have been a strategic asset during the Cold War. By serving as America's proxy after the Six-Day War, 1967, Israel helped contain Soviet expansion in the region and inflicted humiliating defeats on Soviet clients like Egypt and Syria. Israel occasionally helped protect other U.S. allies, like Jordan's King Hussein, and its military prowess forced Moscow to spend more backing its losing clients. Israel also gave the United States useful intelligence about Soviet capabilities. Israel's strategic value during this period should not be overstated, however. Backing Israel was not cheap, and it complicated America's relations with the Arab world. For instance, the U.S. decision to give Israel $2.2 billion in emergency military aid during the October War triggered an OPEC oil embargo that inflicted considerable damage on Western economies. Moreover, Israel's military could not protect U.S. interests in the region. For example, the United States could not rely on Israel when the Iranian Revolution in 1979 raised concerns about the security of Persian Gulf oil supplies and had to create its own rapid deployment force instead. Even if Israel was a strategic asset during the Cold War, the first Gulf War, 90-91, revealed that Israel was becoming a strategic burden. The United States could not use Israeli bases during the war without rupturing the anti-Iraq coalition, and it had to divert resources, for example, Patriot missile batteries, to keep Tel Aviv from doing anything that might fracture the alliance against Saddam. History repeated itself in 2003. Although Israel was eager for the United States to attack Saddam, President Bush could not ask it to help without triggering Arab opposition. So Israel stayed on the sidelines again. Beginning in 1990, and especially after 9/11, U.S. support for Israel has been justified by the claim that both states are threatened by terrorist groups originating in the Arab or Muslim world, and by a set of so-called rogue states that back these groups and seek WMD, or weapons of mass destruction. This rationale implies that Washington should give Israel a free hand in dealing with the Palestinians and not press Israel to make concessions until all Palestinian terrorists are imprisoned or dead. It also implies that the United States should go after countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, the Bashar al-Assad, Syria. Israel is thus seen as a crucial ally in the war on terror because its enemies are America's enemies. This new rationale seems persuasive, but Israel is in fact a liability in the war on terror and the broader effort to deal with so-called rogue states. To begin with, as it's called, terrorism is a tactic employed by a wide array of political groups. It is not a single unified adversary. The terrorist organizations that threaten Israel, for example, Hamas or Hezbollah, do not threaten the United States except when it intervenes against them, as in Lebanon in 1982. Moreover, Palestinian terrorism is not random violence directed against Israel or, quote-unquote, the West. It is largely a response to Israel's prolonged campaign to colonize the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Again, for more information on that, ladies and gentlemen, you might look to the Zionist Violations MP3 series at the Hour of the Time, the ADL series, all available via our website, hourofthetime.com, and then go to the Hot Shop. More importantly, saying that Israel and the United States are united by a shared terrorist threat has the causal relationship backwards. Rather, the United States has a terrorism problem in good part because it is so closely allied with Israel, not the other way around. U.S. support for Israel is not the only source of anti-American terrorism, but it is an important one, and it makes winning the so-called war on terror more difficult. There is no question, for example, that many so-called al-Qaeda leaders, including bin Laden, are motivated by Israel's presence in Jerusalem and the plight of the Palestinians. According to the U.S. 9/11 Commission, bin Laden explicitly sought to punish the United States for its policies in the Middle East, including its support for Israel. And he even tried to time the attacks to highlight this issue. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the reason I brought that up was because, despite what I may feel about the lack of thoroughness or the inadequacy of the 9/11 Commission, the simple fact is the same people that follow this idiotic foreign policy also wrote the 9/11 Commission report. More proof, ladies and gentlemen, that it's all just doublespeak. Back to the topic at hand, equally important, unconditional U.S. support for Israel makes it easier for extremists to rally popular support and to attract recruits. Public opinion polls confirm that Arab populations are deeply hostile to American support for Israel, and the U.S. State Department's Advisory Group on Public Diplomacy for the Arab and Muslim World found that, quote, citizens in these countries are genuinely distressed at the plight of the Palestinian and at the role they perceive the United States to be playing, end quote. As far for so-called rogue states in the Middle East, they are not a dire threat to vital U.S. interest, apart from the U.S. commitment to Israel itself. Although the United States does have a number of disagreements with these regimes, Washington would not be nearly as worried about Iran, Baathist Iraq, or Syria were it not so closely tied to Israel. Even if these states, as us, acquire nuclear weapons, as the Israelis, which may not be desirable, it would not be a strategic disaster for the United States. Neither America nor Israel could be blackmailed by a nuclear-armed road because the blackmailer could not carry out the threat without receiving overwhelming retaliation. The danger of a so-called nuclear handoff to terrorists is equally remote because a so-called rogue state could not be sure the transfer would be undetected or that it would not be blamed and punished afterwards. Furthermore, the U.S. relationship with Israel actually makes it harder to deal with these states. Israel's nuclear arsenal is one reason why some of its neighbors want nuclear weapons. And threatening these states with regime changes merely increases that desire. Yet Israel is not much of an asset when the United States contemplates using force against these regimes because it cannot participate in the fight. In short, treating Israel as America's most important ally in the campaign against terrorism and assorted Middle East dictatorships both exaggerates Israel's ability to help on these issues and ignores the ways that Israel's policies make U.S. efforts more difficult. Unquestioned support for Israel also weakens the U.S. position outside the Middle East. Foreign elites consistently view the United States as too supportive of Israel and think its tolerance of Israeli repression in the occupied territories is morally obtuse and a handicap in the war on terrorism. In April 2004, for example, 52 former British diplomats sent Prime Minister Tony Blair a letter saying that the Israel-Palestinian conflict had, quote, poisoned relations between the West and the Arab and Islamic world, end quote, and warning that the policies of Bush and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon were, quote, one-sided and illegal, end quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you can get that letter, as I have, off of the internet if you want to see it for yourself. And in fact, a letter very similar was written and sent to Bush, which you can also obtain. A final reason to question Israel's strategic value is that it does not act like a loyal ally. Israeli officials frequently ignore U.S. requests and renege on promises made to top U.S. leaders, including past pledges to halt settlement construction and to refrain from targeted assassinations of Palestinian leaders. Moreover, Israel has provided sensitive U.S. military technology to potential U.S. rivals like China in what the U.S. State Department Inspector General called, quote, a systematic and growing pattern of unauthorized transfers, end quote. According to the U.S. General Accounting Office, or GAO, Israel also, quote, conducts the most aggressive espionage operations against the U.S. of any ally. Again, quote, conducts the most aggressive espionage operations against the U.S. of any ally, end quote. In addition to the case of Jonathan Pollard, who gave Israel large quantities of classified material in the early 1980s, which Israel reportedly passed on to the Soviet Union to gain more exit visas for Soviet Jews, a new controversy erupted in 2004 when it was revealed that a key Pentagon official, Larry Franklin, had passed classified information to an Israeli diplomat, allegedly aided by two AIPAC officials. Israel is hardly the only country that spies on the United States, but its willingness to spy on its principal patron casts further doubt on its strategic value. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to get a drink of lemon water here, so we're going to go do a quick musical interlude here, and we'll continue on with what you might call another section, and you might title it A Dwindling Moral Case. Ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the hour of the time. Again, the personal email address to me is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The website, hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942. And the studio number in Canada, 613-733-4324. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, tomorrow night, another exciting broadcast of Mozart's Basement, as well as the Hour of the Time. And also tonight, be sure to stay tuned in for A Healthier You, a new broadcast as well, and The Inner Athlete, a new broadcast as well. So support and tune in to the Hour of the Time in general every day to catch exciting and informative information. Now, ladies and gentlemen, ironically, I got a call lambasting me for not providing this stream that you're listening to right now for free. I would like to know how many of you were charged when you clicked listen here to the stream tonight. Obviously, that gentleman is nothing but a fool and an idiot. And I told him that and then hung up. Ladies and gentlemen, the only way we can provide that throw is through your support. Think about that. Now, under that new section, if you will, about a dwindling moral case, apart from its alleged strategic value, Israel's backers also argue that it deserves unqualified U.S. support because, one, it is weak and surrounded by enemies. Two, it is a democracy, which is morally preferable form of government. Three, the Jewish people have suffered from past crimes and therefore deserve special treatment. And four, Israel's conduct has been morally superior to its adversaries' behavior. On close inspection, however, each of these arguments is unpersuasive. There is a strong moral case for supporting Israel's existence, but that is not in jeopardy. Viewed objectively, Israel's past and present conduct offers no moral basis for privileging it over the Palestinians. Do we back the underdog, ladies and gentlemen? Israel's often portrayed as weak and besieged, a Jewish David surrounded by a hostile Arab Goliath. This image has been carefully nurtured by Israeli leaders and sympathetic writers, but the opposite image is closer to the truth. Contrary to popular belief, the Zionists had larger, better equipped, and better led forces during the 1947-49 War of Independence, and the Israel Defense Force won quick and easy victories against Egypt in 1956 and against Egypt, Jordan, and Syria in 1967 before large-scale U.S. aid began flowing to Israel. These victories offer eloquent evidence of Israeli patriotism, organizational ability, and the military prowess. But they also reveal that Israel was far from helpless, even in its earliest years. Today, Israel is the strongest military power in the Middle East. Its conventional forces are far superior to its neighbors, and it is the only state in that region with nuclear weapons. Egypt and Jordan signed peace treaties with Israel, and Saudi Arabia has offered to do so as well. Syria has lost its Soviet patron. Iraq has been decimated by three disastrous wars, and Iran is hundreds of miles away. The Palestinians barely have effective police, let alone a military that could threaten Israel. According to a 2005 assessment of Tel Aviv by Tel Aviv University's prestigious Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies. Again, by Tel Aviv University's prestigious Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies, quote, the strategic balance decidedly favors Israel, which has continued to widen the qualitative gap between its own military capability and deterrence powers and those of its neighbors, end quote. If backing the underdog were a compelling rationale, the United States would be supporting Israel's opponents. Now, are we aiding a fellow democracy, as is often brought up? American backing is often justified, ladies and gentlemen, by the claim that Israel is a fellow democracy, surrounded by hostile dictatorships. And while this rationale sounds convincing, but it cannot account for the current level of U.S. support. After all, there are many so-called democracies around the world, but none receives the lavish support that Israel does. The United States has overthrown democratic governments in the past and supported dictators when this was thought to advance U.S. interest. And it has good relations with a number of dictatorships today. Thus, being so-called democratic, neither justifies nor explains America's support for Israel. The so-called shared democracy rationale is also weakened by aspects of Israeli democracy that are at odds with core American values. The United States is deemed a liberal democracy where people of any race, religion, or ethnicity are supposed to enjoy equal rights. By contrast, Israel was explicitly founded as a Jewish state, and citizenship is based on the principle of blood kinship. Given this conception of citizenship, it is not surprising that Israel's 1.3 million Arabs are treated as second-class citizens, or that a recent Israeli government commission found that Israel behaves in a, quote, neglectful and discriminatory, end quote, manner towards them. Similarly, Israel does not permit Palestinians who marry Israeli citizens to become citizens themselves, and does not give these spouses the right to live in Israel. The Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, called this restriction, quote, a racist law that determines who can live here according to racist criteria, end quote. Such laws may be understandable given Israel's founding principles, but they are not consistent with America's image of democracy. Israel's democratic status is also undermined by its refusal to grant the Palestinians a viable state of their own. Israel controls the lives of about 3.8 million Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, while colonizing lands on which the Palestinians have long dwelt. Israel is formally democratic, but the millions of Palestinians that it controls are denied full political rights, and the so-called shared democracy rationale is correspondingly weakened. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I can refer you not only to these broadcasts that will make up this series that you can donate for to support the Hour of the Time, but also the ADL series, the Zionist Violation series, and on and on and on, to give you a thorough and documented understanding of events around the world and through history. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a little offer for tonight. If you email me during this broadcast, I'll see the date and time, obviously, when I get off the air. Email me during this broadcast right now, Wednesday, the 10th of February, 2010, while it's live, and I'll send you a report that has all the citations these two professors used to make these claims. From the John F. Kennedy Government School of Harvard University, ladies and gentlemen, I'll send that to you for free in PDF format. Email me now during this broadcast, and I'll check the emails when I get off the air. Email me at hourthetime@hotmail.com for that special bonus. Again, go check out all the sites. To cover all this material, ladies and gentlemen, hitting each site as I move along would take hundreds of hours of broadcasting. I don't think that really has any point when it's already been written and documented. I can pass that on to you if you email me tonight, February 10th, 2010, Wednesday, while this broadcast is new. For free, I'll send that to you, ladies and gentlemen, because in researching their claims and using the wonderful footnotes and citations that they made, hundreds of them, in fact, 41 pages of report in a white paper form, and 42 pages of citations. That is a ton of citations. It has given me hundreds of hours of additional reading. And it can you too, ladies and gentlemen. Do your research. Check it out. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we might call the next section, if you will, or not a section, a subsection that we laid out here, But oftentimes it's been told by proponents of this undue support that Israel gets. Proponents will often say, whether U.S. or Israeli, well, it's compensation for past crimes. And it's even sometimes called a third moral justification. Now, supposedly it relies upon the history of Jewish suffering in the Christian West, especially the strategic episode of the Holocaust. Because Jews were persecuted for centuries and can only be safe in a Jewish homeland, many believe that Israel deserves special treatment from the United States. While there is no question that Jews suffered greatly from the despicable legacy of so-called anti-Semitism, and that Israel's creation was an appropriate response to a long record of crimes, this history, as noted, provides a strong moral case for supporting Israel's existence. But the creation of Israel involved additional crimes against a largely innocent third party, the Palestinians. The history of these events is well understood. When political Zionism began in earnest in the late 19th century, there were only about 15,000 Jews in Palestine. In 1893, for example, the Arabs comprised roughly 95% of the population. And though under Ottoman control, they had been in continuous possession of this territory for 1,300 years. Even when Israel was founded, Jews were only about 35% of Palestine's population and owned 7% of the land. All cited, ladies and gentlemen. Email me, hourthetime@hotmail.com. You can look those sites up. The mainstream Zionist leadership was not interested in establishing a binational state or accepting a permanent partition of Palestine. The Zionist leadership was sometimes willing to accept partition as a first step, but this was a tactical maneuver and not their real objective. As David Ben-Gurion put in the late 1930s, quote, "After the formation of a large army in the wake of the establishment of the state, we shall abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine," end quote. To achieve this goal, the Zionists had to expel large numbers of Arabs from the territory that would eventually become Israel. There was simply no other way to accomplish their objective. Ben-Gurion saw the problem clearly, writing in 1941 that, quote, "It is impossible to imagine general evacuation of the Arab population without compulsion and brutal compulsion," end quote. Or, as Israeli historian Benny Morris puts it, quote, "The idea of transfer is as old as modern Zionism and has accompanied its evolution and praxis during the past century," end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening. Your host here, Doyle Shamley, on the Hour of the Time, the website hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And don't forget to visit the Hot Shop for many wonderful research projects laid down in PDF and DVD and MP3 format as a way of you to support our network. I hope everyone took a studious notes and have a safe evening.